This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You must remember, a kiss is just a kiss, a smile for
Welcome to another episode of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century, part of the Panoply Network. I'm your host, Karina Longworth, and this is another installment in our ongoing series, Bela and Boris.
Once upon a time, many, many years ago,
I am Dracula.
It's alive! Oh, in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God.
I was greater than any real vampire.
Sure.
Awake.
Have I been asleep?
She hate me. Like others.
A race of atomic supermen which will conquer the world.
The phone is dead. Even the phone is dead.
We belong dead.
We are heading into the third act of this series, which will consist of two episodes that will trace the final acts of Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff's lives. Today we'll focus on Bela, who by the late 1940s had been cast aside by Hollywood. Broke, depressed, and dependent on the pain medication he was still taking to move around despite his debilitating sciatica, Lugosi found himself lured into the web of Edward D. Wood, Jr., better known as Ed Wood. Ed Wood has acquired the reputation of being, if not the worst filmmaker of all time, then the worst filmmaker living in Hollywood in the 20th century who made use of some recognizable stars. Some of that reputation owes to conservative pundit Michael Medved, who declared in a 1980 book that Plan 9 from Outer Space, the film Wood considered to be his magnum opus, was in fact the worst film ever made. This brought more attention to Wood than he had ever had in his lifetime, which ended in 1978, when the alcoholic Wood was penniless and had recently become homeless. Wood's movies tend to be sincerely creative, badly acted, and shoddily produced. But as laughably inept as they could be, Wood's end was still a sad one for anyone, let alone a World War II veteran who had always loved movies, who had come to Hollywood believing he could be the next Orson Welles, and who kept his merry band of misfit drinking buddies occupied making movies, at least for a little while. Today we will explain how Bela joined that merry gang, and how his relationship with Wood was both mutually beneficial and possibly exploitative and destructive. And we will discuss how the man, who became famous for playing undead, finally met a coffin that he couldn't rise out of. Join us, won't you? For the second to last chapter of Bela and Boris.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
After Abbott and Costello meets Frankenstein, Bela Lugosi could not get movie work. He went back on the road as Dracula. In 1948, he put together a traveling vaudeville act, which continued in various forms through 1950. In one incarnation of the show, audiences were made to sit through the late Lugosi film, The Ape Man, and then, after the movie, the curtains parted to reveal Lugosi rising from his coffin. Then he would do some business on a laboratory set with his wife, Lillian, and a man in a gorilla suit. The show was embarrassing, and the audiences that did show up were filled with teenagers looking to laugh at an old man. They got their money's worth. Bela, meanwhile, was barely breaking even, and a subsequent tour of the British provinces as Dracula didn't do much to help his bottom line or his confidence. Backstage, he would gaze at his image in the mirror and wonder,
"Can it be that you once played Romeo?"
3.5 years went by before he was offered another movie role, and it wasn't as Romeo. While in England, Bela was cast as the vampire in a spoof comedy. This film would flop in Britain and wouldn't be released in the US until 1964. Bela returned to the US in 1951 with a box of German methadone in his luggage. The drug, available without a prescription in Europe, was supposed to help with his chronic pain while also helping him break his addiction to morphine. But Bela goosed the effect of the methadone by combining it with Demerol when he injected it. He was also taking barbiturates to help him sleep. The movie industry, particularly the low end of the industry that had kept Bela working even when the major studios weren't calling, had been thrown into chaos by the advent of television. Over the course of 20 years, Bela had become used to low-budget producers calling him up and casting him to provide star power for their cheap horror cash-ins. Sometimes these independently made or barely financed films allowed Lugosi to have some fun. But in 1952, when a call finally did come for Lugosi, it was from a producer who so blatantly wanted to capitalize on the Lugosi name that he actually put it in the title of the movie. Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla was a comedy built around Sammy Petrillo and Duke Mitchell, a couple of Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin impersonators, and the plot would have Bela playing a mad scientist who plots to turn Duke into a gorilla when the younger man becomes his rival for a beautiful girl. Bela, gaunt and aged, and unhappily weaning off of drugs, was accompanied on the set of this film by Alex Gordon, a Lugosi superfan who was serving as an all-purpose assistant to the old man and was also trying to help him find work. Gordon had even started writing a screenplay for Bela in collaboration with his roommate. That roommate was Edward D. Wood Jr. Like Alex Gordon, Ed Wood had long been a fan of Lugosi's, although Wood's all-time favorite movie was The Mummy, starring Boris Karloff. Wood was a born storyteller. The problem was that he had more talent for telling stories over drinks than he did for translating his stories into cinema. But boy, could he drunk bullshit. His widow, Kathy, claimed he had told her that he had been a spy while he was in the Marines, and after the war, he joined the Ice Capades, working undercover to finger German and Russian spies who were also masquerading as figure skaters. Ed had also told Kathy that while he was working in the story department at Universal in the late 1940s, he had met Tony Curtis and Danny Kaye, who, he told Kathy, were, like him, men who liked to dress up in women's clothes. Wood referred to himself as a transvestite or crossdresser. Who knows how his identity would have manifested itself in a more open time, but during Wood's time, he was not what we generally refer to today as transgender. He didn't pursue a sex change operation or dress as a woman full-time. He was a straight man who enjoyed sex with straight women, and he also derived sexual and emotional pleasure from wearing women's clothes, particularly Angora sweaters. Some of his friends believed the clothing itself was the fetish for Wood, that just putting on a woman's sweater was psychologically the same thing to him as a seduction. As one of Wood's girlfriends put it, it's like he loves women so much he's taking on the persona, having this woman wrapped around him and in him. Ed did, however, feel some kinship with Christine Jorgensen, the first American to openly reveal that she had undergone sexual reassignment surgery to transform from anatomically male to anatomically female. In 1953, when Wood first met Lugosi, after a few false starts, Wood was finally getting a chance to write and direct his own feature film, inspired by Jorgensen's story, in which Wood himself would play a man named Glenn, struggling to reveal to his female fiancé his secret life as Glenda. There was no logical part in this quasi-documentary film for Bela, but that didn't stop Wood from reaching out to the aged star. At first, Bela turned down the project, not because of the subject matter, but because he was tired of toiling away for independent producers who didn't value him. But his wife knew that Bela needed to work, and they needed the money. So Lillian took Bela to Ed's apartment. Lillian spoke for Bela and told Ed that if he could double the $500 salary he had originally offered Bela, then Bela would do it. Ed wasn't sure that would fly with his producer, George Weiss, an exploitation distributor who had never made a movie with a star in it. But Weiss reluctantly agreed that Bela Lugosi was worth $1,000. And Lugosi's odd final act had begun. Glenn or Glenda is a truly bizarre, almost avant-garde mishmash, combining stock footage of street scenes lightning and stampeding buffalo with footage Wood shot of himself and his sometime girlfriend Dolores Fuller, who had actually left Wood because she couldn't handle his cross-dressing, acting out a domestic drama similar to their own, but with a happy ending. There would be two framing devices. In one, actor Lyle Talbot would play a police officer seeking advice from a doctor while investigating the suicide of a man who was found dead dressed like a woman. In the other, Bela Lugosi sits in a chair musing about humanity and acting as a kind of god figure blessing Glenn's transformation? I think.
People. All going somewhere. All with their own thoughts, their own ideas. All with their own personalities.
One is wrong because he does right. And one is right because he does wrong. Pull the string. Dance to that which one is created for.
When shooting Bela, Ed gave very specific instructions to his cinematographer.
I want light right in his eyes to make it look like he's staring out into the world, just like in White Zombie.
Wood's cinematographer didn't know how to achieve this effect, but Lillian Lugosi did. She had been Bela's secretary on the set of White Zombie. Lillian said, "Someone get a cardboard box." Someone went and got her a shoebox. And she poked two holes in it and told the cinematographer to put the light behind it. It's hard to judge if Ed got the lighting effect he was going for, in part because Glen or Glenda is only available to stream in a colorized version that flattens out whatever photographic effects his shoestring crew was able to achieve. For what it's worth, this same fate has befallen The Outlaw, a not-great film with truly beautiful black-and-white photography by Greg Toland, and that's a travesty. In the case of Glen or Glenda, and the other Ed Wood movies available on iTunes, it's hard to say that the colorization makes the movie worse. And in fact, it does enhance the kitsch and camp aspects of the films, which probably makes them easier for modern audiences to watch. What it does not do is obscure Ed Wood's legendary, lackadaisical attitude toward quality control. In order to stretch Glen or Glenda out to 70 minutes to make it acceptable for distribution, Wood had to use every single scrap of footage that he shot over the three-day shoot, plus all the stock footage he could cram in, and there wasn't money for reshoots or dubbing, or to pay attention to continuity. So at times, the editing of the film appears simply inept. At the same time, there is a certain creativity to it, particularly in Wood's use of superimposition and optically printed split screens. At times, Glen or Glenda feels like a Kenneth Anger film, except not beautiful and way too literal. Used to selling films based on a veneer of quote-unquote reality, distributor Weiss attempted to find real people who had had sex change operations to make public appearances to support Glen or Glenda. He came up short. One woman he met with told him she wouldn't support a movie about transvestism starring Bela Lugosi because Bela Lugosi signified horror, and she didn't want her experience associated with horror. After Glen or Glenda, Lugosi's wife, Lillian, left him. She had gone to work when her husband hadn't been able to find any, and this professional independence had given her the courage to leave a relationship that hadn't been working for her for about a decade. Without work, all Bela did was sit around the apartment and drink, and Lillian finally had enough. After she walked out on him, Bela was devastated. He wrote her letters, begging her to come back. He swore he was now sober and going to AA. But she did not come back, and in mid-1953, she filed for divorce. With his wife gone, Bela said,
"I went back on the drugs. My heart was broken."
Bela started hanging out at Ed and Alex's apartment. Everyone would be drinking, and Ed would sometimes be wearing stockings and angora. Bela didn't care. Who was he to judge what made another man happy? And Ed would come over to Bela's house and drink with him and watch movies on TV. And Ed would overlook Bela's periodic dips behind a curtain to inject himself with drugs. There are different points of view on the Bela Lugosi-Ed Wood relationship. Lugosi's biographer, Arthur Lenig, believes Ed Wood was a no-talent parasite who preyed on Lugosi and destroyed his legacy. Ed Wood believed that he was Bela's only friend, and he was determined to make movies with him that restored Dracula to his former glory. Both of these points of view may be valid. It does seem clear that Wood exploited Bela, and also that he made him feel loved and wanted in a way that no filmmaker had for decades. With Ed Wood, Bela got to be part of something. It may not have been something good, but it still felt good to belong. If nothing else, Eddie made Bela laugh. Wood and Lugosi's next film together was originally titled Bride of the Atom and finally released as Bride of the Monster. Ed promised to pay Bela $1,000 a day and guaranteed the old actor a shoot of 5 days. But Wood kept having to shut down the production because he'd run out of money. When that happened, he'd rent a private room at a restaurant, invite potential investors, and present Bela as something to invest in. When Ed would get a little bit of money, he'd pay Bela first to keep him happy and to keep Bela in the drugs that would stave off withdrawal. Bela was not well when Bride of the Monster was being shot, and the shoot kept dragging on and on. At one point, he told Ed he was too sick to continue shooting, unless they paid him an extra $250 a day. Ed found the money, and Bela returned to shoot at a fake lake the production had built in the middle of the night, secretly, in Griffith Park. It was freezing, and Bela wanted to shoot up. He said,
"Eddie, take me home. I've got to take my medicine."
Paul Marco, another member of Wood's stock company, was assigned the job of taking Bela home so he could get what he needed. Marco watched as Bela went into a little utility closet and pulled the curtain. He left it open just enough that Marco could watch as the actor put on an apron, carefully tying the straps in a little bow. He rolled up his sleeves, washed his hands, dried them with a clean towel, and then sterilized his needle. He injected himself, then sterilized his needle again, put it away, rolled down his sleeves, untied his apron, and drew back the curtain. Now he was ready to do what Ed Wood needed him to do. If Glenn or Glenda had drawn from Wood's own life, with Bride of the Monster, he wrote in some of Bela's own history. Bela had told Ed a story about how after he was famous, the new government in Hungary that he had fled sent a representative to meet him and ask Bela to come back to Hungary to serve as Minister of Culture. Bela refused. He was sure it was a trap to get him into the gulag. Thus, he gave a typically florid and not entirely sensical Ed Wood speech his all.
"Now I am here, sent to bring you home.
Home? I have no home. Hunted. Despised. Living like an animal. The jungle is my home. That I will show the world that I can be its master. I will perfect my own race of people. A race of atomic supermen which will conquer the world."
"Yes. Yes, of course. A truly great master race. Such as I convinced my superiors only you could create.
one with which our government can rule the world without debate.
You misunderstand me, Strausky. I don't intend to return home. My plans are for myself.
Are you mad, Voronoff?
One is always considered mad if one discovers something that others cannot grasp.
Bela was initially worried that he wouldn't be able to remember this long speech, and Wood had cue cards prepared for his star. But when it came time to shoot, Bela said he didn't need the cards. He performed the whole speech in a single take. More than giving Bela a chance to speak to the fact that his homeland literally no longer existed in the same form as when he was born, this speech gives him a chance to talk back to the studio system that left him for dead, and to embrace the jungle he now found himself in with Ed Wood, and the iconoclasm that both of them represented, whether or not anyone else understood or appreciated what they were doing. The vicarious victory continues right after this speech, when his character then gets to capture and have his way with the stand-in for the studio system. Bela looks like he's having a lot of fun in Bride of the Monster, but his biographer insisted that he was totally perplexed and annoyed with Wood's directorial style, which involved making it up as he went along and breezing through the material so quickly that most scenes were only given one take. Wood could not afford to pay the lab to get the print of Bride of the Monster finished, so he made a deal with Sam Arkoff to own and distribute the movie. Arkoff supposedly made a profit off of Bride of the Monster, and with that profit he started a company called American International Pictures, which would become the driving force in B-movies and youth culture exploitation over the next decade, and would also become the home of Boris Karloff's final American movies. But we'll get to that next week. Wood also claimed Arkoff stole an idea Ed had written for Lugosi, about an old horror star who seeks revenge on the studio that dropped him. This was more or less the premise of the American International picture, How to Make a Monster, which was about a disgruntled monster makeup man instead of an actor. But Arkoff denied he stole the premise from Wood, or that Wood's movie had made him any money at all. Immediately after shooting Bride of the Monster, Bela checked himself into the motion picture country home to get treatment for his addiction. After 3 weeks there, he was kicked out because it was discovered that he hadn't amassed enough recent credits to merit treatment under the facility's rules. He was forced to move to the Los Angeles State Mental Hospital. Indigent, Bela was forced to appear before a judge in order to determine what the state could do for him. Bela explained how he had come to this point.
I used it so, and so only, I could work. I used to inject the methadone in my legs, but I lost 50 pounds from 180 pounds to 130. And my limbs became just strings of muscle. When I could no longer find a place to inject, that was the end.
To journalists who were suddenly interested in Bela's plight, he claimed he had been addicted for 20 years. His ex-wife, Lillian, rolled her eyes at this claim. When she was around, she insisted, Bela's use was manageable. She insisted he only became a dope fiend after the divorce. She believed that Bela was so happy to be back in the headlines that he was giving the newspapers a better story. Ed Wood and his gang were more supportive. Wood threw a benefit premiere of Bride of the Monster while Bela was still in the hospital. He announced that all of the proceeds from ticket sales would go to Bela. but he wasn't able to sell many tickets. Even after petitioning Universal to buy a block to help throw some scraps to their old Dracula. Bela spent 3 months in the hospital. When he was released, Ed took Bela to see Bride of the Monster at the United Artists Theater in Westwood. Afterward, they went outside so that Bela could smoke a cigar. An old man on the street recognized Lugosi and begged for an autograph.
"I'm 62 years old," the man told Bela. "I feel very old."
Bela puffed out his chest and said,
"I am 71, but the brain, it never feels that you're old. Only the body looks old, but never the brain. The brain is young, then the body is still like a young man."
Like the young man he had been, a no longer dope-addled Lugosi took advantage of his newfound health to pursue a relationship with a fan who had sent him many letters while he was sick. Hope Leninger, a clerk at RKO, had signed each of her letters to Bela, "A Dash of Hope." Bela said that this dash of hope had helped see him through his ordeal. And on August 24th, 1955, he and the 30-something Hope were married. There were 13 guests at the ceremony and at least a dozen photographers. Bela was drunk. Hope told a reporter, "I've been a fan of Bela's since I was a kid." Ed Wood drove Bela and Hope to their honeymoon at a motel across the county line. They got two rooms, one for Bela and Hope, and another for Ed, so that he could drive them home in the morning. In the middle of the night, Ed woke up to see Bela standing over him, undulating his fingers in the Dracula pose.
"Eddie, what do you want with Hope?"
I don't want anything, Bela."
Bela was insecure about his ability to please his new young wife. He wasn't as virile as he used to be.
"I'd try to cheer him up, tease him for getting such a young dish to marry him to begin with, but he'd get real down and confide in me. What am I going to do? I do not get the big prig anymore."
Bela was feeling well enough initially after his release that he wanted to make a movie right away. So Ed scrambled to come up with some material. He wrote something called The Ghoul Goes West, starring Bela as a mad scientist preying on cowboys, but Bela wasn't strong enough to ride a horse. Wood then got a camera and some film and told Bela to put on his cape. They went to a graveyard, and Wood shot Bela walking around. Then Ed started writing a script around this footage, creating parts for some of the other misfits that he had collected in his menagerie, including strongman Tor Johnson and the TV horror hostess Vampira, whose real name was Mela Nurmi. Ed knew Bela had a crush on Vampira. Ed and Bela had watched her show together, and Bela had told him how much he wanted to make a movie with her. And so Ed started writing a part for Bela as Vampira's husband. But months dragged by, and Ed could not gather money to make a movie. Bela was cast in a small, non-speaking part in a movie called The Black Sleep, alongside a number of other horror stars of the past, such as Basil Rathbone and Lon Chaney Jr. The fact that his character was mute was hugely frustrating for Bela, and at one point, he made some kind of muttering comment to Chaney about Son of Dracula. Himself past what had passed for his prime, Chaney picked up the old emaciated Lugosi and threw him over his shoulder, apparently intending to throw him across the room. Chaney was stopped in time, and the crew made sure to keep the two old ghouls separated from then on. Meanwhile, Bela's new marriage was not going well. Bela had become partially deaf with old age, and he would often say disparaging things about Hope to his friends, speaking very loudly, not realizing that even though she was in the other room, she could hear him. Hope tried to prevent him from drinking. He was unhappy. He would call his now grown son and complain that Hope had found his stash of bottles and poured them down the drain. And yet, Bela must have had some desire to not drink, because he regularly went to AA meetings. They were a part of a circuit of activities with which Bela now filled his days. He'd go to Social Security and pick up his retirement check, go to the movies. He'd meet with Ed and read his latest script. He'd meet with Forrest Ackerman, a horror and sci-fi enthusiast who would soon start the fan magazine Famous Monsters of Filmland. He'd stop by homes where he used to live, unannounced, knock on the door, and the new owners would let him and whomever was with him in to look around. They were always happy to see him. There was a Hungarian restaurant he liked to go to on Sunset Boulevard. The nights would always start happy and would end with all the Hungarians drunk crying. In August 1956, Bela woke up, groggy from having had too much scotch, and told Hope that Boris Karloff had come to visit him and was waiting in the living room. Boris, of course, was not there. 2 weeks later, Hope got home from work, put the groceries away, and went into the bedroom, where she found Bela stretched out on the bed. She thought he might be dead. "I patted him all over," Hope recalled. "He seemed to be all nice and toasty warm. He must have just died. I wanted to make damn sure before I called somebody. If I got people in there and he wasn't really dead, just drunk, he'd be mad as a hornet." Hope went upstairs to their landlord, who brought a small mirror and held it up to Bela's mouth. It didn't fog up. "Well," Hope said, "let's put the liquor bottles away, shall we? Before we call the police or anybody." Bela was buried in his Dracula costume. Ed Wood was the lead pallbearer. Wood would soon take the footage of Bela that he had shot in the graveyard and work it into a film that he wanted to call Grave Robbers from Outer Space, but which he was forced by his investors to title Plan 9 from Outer Space. Bela's role was padded out by footage that Wood shot of his new wife Kathy's chiropractor/hypnotist holding his cape up to cover most of his face. ...73 years is a decent length for a life, but there's no question that Bela died too soon. In 1957, Universal sold a package of their horror movies to television, and this helped turn a whole new generation into monster movie addicts. Characters like Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Mummy became part of the youth culture, seeping into rock and roll via novelty songs like Dinner with Drac, composed and performed by Philadelphia horror host John Zacherle.
A dinner was served for three at Dracula's house by the sea. The hors d'oeuvres were fine, but I choked on my wine when I learned that the main course was me.
This created an even larger market for horror movies on TV. And Ed Wood's movies, even the ones that never had a substantive theatrical release, became ubiquitous on the small screen. By the 1960s, Bela Lugosi was as familiar to TV watchers as Lucille Ball. This resurgence in popularity of his movies may not have led to aged Bela Lugosi getting more acting work, but he would have loved to see his work appreciated. Over the years, Ed worked on a memoir of Bela,
which he thought could be a book or even a movie. He was going to call it Bela Lugosi Postmortem. But Ed Wood's life didn't get any easier, and he and his wife, Kathy, became pretty serious alcoholics. One morning in 1978, they were evicted from their apartment. They were each allowed to take just one suitcase. Ed was able to grab his favorite Angora sweater and one of his unproduced screenplays called I Woke Up Early on the Day I Died. He forgot to grab his writings on Bela, and they were lost forever. Ed and Kathy ended up crashing with their friend, Peter Coe. One Sunday afternoon, drunk again during the day, Ed went into Peter's bedroom to lie down. They found him there a little while later, dead with his eyes open. 2 years later, Plan 9 from Outer Space was declared the worst film ever made. Next week, in our final episode of this season, we will explore Boris Karloff's final act. Join us then, won't you? Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Our editors are Jacob Smith and Sam Dingman. And our logo was designed by Teddy Blinks. Special thanks to our special guests, Taryn Killam, who played Bela Lugosi, and Noah Segan, who played Ed Wood. For more information about the show, please go to our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. There you'll find show notes, which include information about our sources, the music we use, and much more. If you like the podcast, please tell anyone you can, any way that you can. You can follow us on Twitter at RememberThisPod, and we're on Facebook and Instagram, too. We'll be back next week with one last installment from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.